From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's edition of Fresh Air, I speak with comic Yakov Smirnoff. Since emigrating from the Soviet Union 10 years ago, Smirnoff has become one of America's hottest comics. Also today, I talk with playwright Wendy Wasserstein. Her latest work, Drive, She Said, is featured on the new public television comedy series, Trying Times. Rock critic Ken Tucker reviews Introducing the Hard Line, according to Terence Trent D'Arby. D'Arby's well known in England. The new album is his first American release. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews Hope and Glory, John Borman's new movie that examines World War II through a child's eyes. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. My guest is comic Yakov Smirnoff. 10 years ago, he emigrated with his parents from the Soviet Union to America. In the Soviet Union, Smirnoff entertained the troops after he was drafted into the army. When he got out, he worked as a comic on Soviet cruise ships. When he and his parents arrived in the United States, none of them spoke English, and they only had about $100. Today, Smirnoff is one of the most successful comics in this country. He drives a Rolls Royce and lives in a home overlooking Los Angeles. He's developed a comic persona who lampoons Soviet-style communism and jokes about how American culture confuses him. It's gone over quite well here. He performs in comedy clubs across the country. He's been on The Tonight Show, and he appeared in the films Moscow on the Hudson, Brewster's Millions, Buckaroo Banzai, and Heartburn. Last year, he starred in his own syndicated TV series, What a Country. Smirnoff's anti-Soviet humor has made a fan of President Reagan, who invited him to perform at a White House dinner for the Conservative Political Action Conference. His latest accomplishment is a new book. It's titled America on 6 Rubles a Day, and it's just been published by Vintage Books. Welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
You started doing stand-up when you were in the Soviet Union. Now, I know absolutely nothing about what comedy is like in the Soviet Union. Could you give us any examples of the kinds of routines you were doing when you were in the Soviet Union?
Well, comedy is pretty much similar to vaudeville comedy in America like 30, 50 years ago, whatever there was, when people weren't telling jokes about politics that much. Not that much about government or whatever. They would tell jokes about their, you know, mother-in-law or a wife, you know, this overweight or whatever, or a neighbor who is drunk. And that's basically what they do in Russia. That's the safest way of telling jokes, because normally the jokes you hear on stage are very old jokes that proven with time. They're all been censored. And there's a department of jokes that censors the material, and it sounds so weird to Americans. And every minister of culture of every republic has a department of music, department of jokes, and they censor your material once a year, and you have to stay with the script for a year. That's it. You can't change anything. You're like a tape recorder. You walk out, and you just tell jokes.
So you had to do the exact same routine
exactly,
over and over for a year.
For a year.
You must have gotten that down pretty well.
Pretty much so, yes. And if someone heckles you from the audience, you can't say, like, your mother wears army boots, because she probably does, and she'll hurt you. So there is not that much happening, and you creatively, you just suffer. I didn't like it. And then I was lucky to work on the cruise ships where I met people from other countries who were touring around the Soviet Union. And people were so, you could see that they were taking chances, they would say whatever they would want. And I started to realize, wait a minute, there's maybe better life than what I have. And
is there any way, I don't know if this would translate or not, could you possibly tell us one of the jokes or do a small excerpt of a routine that you would do in the Soviet Union?
Sure, sure. I would tell jokes like, for example, little ant got married to female elephant. And after first wedding night, elephant died. And little ant said, only one night I enjoyed myself. And now for the rest of my life, I have to dig this grave. This would be one of those jokes that I would tell. Now, that would border on the line almost that something you wouldn't be able to tell.
Well, what's political about that?
Elephant could have been the Communist Party, and if you, I mean, they could create. I mean, so when you submit material like that, you never know; it might be cut out easily. I had a joke that was cut out, had nothing really bad in it, that I was talking about that I lived in a communal apartment with my family, with my parents, in the same bedroom till I was 26 years old. And when my parents, when I was a kid, and my parents would want to make love, they would send me to look out the window. And then my dad would say, "What do you see in the window?" I said, "Our neighbors making love." He said, "How can you tell?" I said, "Because their son is looking at me." That joke was cut out, and they felt that I was making fun of their political, of the economic problems.
When you were in the army, you were entertaining the troops. Was this the equivalent of a Bob Hope type of thing?
Well, yeah, I was younger.
Right. That's the only difference.
Right. Basically, yes, it was similar. You travel around and you tell stories to soldiers. Yeah.
Are hecklers as much of a problem in the Soviet Union for comics as they are in America?
No, they don't heckle much.
Seriously,
no,
they don't?
Yeah, no, they don't. People, first of all, there's no drinking in clubs. They're mostly like theaters. So people get drunk already there. I mean, they go there and they're drunk. And the fear, as comedians, has a lot of fear to say something wrong. Heckler has the same kind of fear. He doesn't want to get hurt.
Comic Yakov Smirnov is my guest, and he's, by the way, written a new book called America on 6 rubles a Day. Now, you got out of the Soviet Union. Was it hard to do? Was it hard for you to get out?
It wasn't easy. They don't call you and say, "Would you please let, you know, would you please go to America or something?" You apply for a visa, and it takes a long time. What they do to discourage people who might have a thought of leaving, they make it as difficult for you as possible. They investigate you, they fire you from work, they turn people against you. It's like 60 minutes. And they eventually, some people luckier, some people not. In my case, I was lucky. And they also, what surprises Americans, that they tell you to take your parents with you, which is, it's, yeah, because they don't want to take care of older people. They release a young person, then they say take them, you know, so they save on the pension and the whole thing. They don't have to worry about medical care for them and stuff like that.
So you were able to travel as a family.
Yeah, which was great. You know, I was, because if I wouldn't have my parents here, I would not probably, I would be homesick a lot more. I mean, I don't, you know, I don't feel it now, but if I wouldn't have my parents with me, I would.
I really can't imagine how you could have thought that you would make it in America as a comic, knowing that you didn't even speak English.
I didn't know either. I mean, this was something that I wanted to leave Soviet Union. At a certain point, I realized that I want to go. And I didn't care what I would do here. And when I came out here and we landed in Kennedy Airport, and I didn't speak a word of English, and they asked me for the interpreter at the airport in the immigration office, "What do you want to do in America?" And I said, "I want to do comedy." And they start laughing, you know, the people who, at the immigration
office.
You
got your first laugh.
Yeah, and I'm going, this is great. You know, what a country. You know, I'm already making people laugh. Then next laugh was about 6 or 8 months later, but it's okay. It made me realize that people are people and they're enjoying comedy.
You went to bartending school for a while,
right.
Learned how to be a bartender.
That's right.
And you worked at Grossinger's, which was one of the very big resort hotels in the Catskills,
right.
in the Borscht Belt. It's really the capital
of
Jewish humor in,
right.
in America. You must have been pretty surprised at what Catskill Mountain Resort vacations were like.
Yes, I was. But you know what? It reminded me a lot of a cruise ship on the Black Sea.
Uh-huh.
Actually, I don't know if you've ever been there. There was an area that was like between a showroom and a service bar that looked like a lobby of a cruise ship. And I walked in there and I said, this is great. This is just what I'm used to and what I know. And I said, I don't care what I got to do here. If I have to wash dishes or whatever, I'll stay. And that was a smart decision at that time. I did not make much money. You know, it was like $1.50 an hour plus tips or whatever. was ridiculously low. And hard work, worked very hard.
You were working at the bar?
Well, as a bar boy first, and then became a bartender. But bar boy brings glasses and puts in beer and stuff like that. And that was for a while, but I realized that I liked it. I wanted to be there. And about a year ago, I went back there as a headliner. And last time I was there, I was a bartender. And, you know, I was making a little bit more money than $1.50 an hour.
Did you spend a lot of time trying to understudy some of the comics appearing at the nightclub at the hotel?
Absolutely. I mean, that was my beginning. I did not understand most of the stuff yet. And I would listen to them, and the timing was similar. The punchlines, I could understand some punchlines, and like I figured out one joke that was, I used to have that joke for a long time in my act about, and I figured it out just by punchline because I did not speak English, and the punchline was, I'll tell the, no, I shouldn't do the punchline for, anyway, the joke was about the exhibition of women's underwear. And so a French woman asked for to buy 7 pair, and they asked her why, and she said, well, it's Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, I need the... And then American woman asked for 5 pair for Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, because Saturday and Sunday she didn't need it. And then Russian woman asked for 12 pair, and they said, why? She said, well, it's January, February, March, And I did not know what they were saying, what it was about, but I recognized Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and then I recognized January, February. And I said, I know that joke. And I knew that when I was in Russia. So I translated it, and I said, wow, this is great. It's the same type of thing. So that was my discovery of that American humor was similar to Russian humor.
So you use that joke in your routine?
Yeah, for a long time. It was like public domain joke.
I mean, but how do you feel about criticizing Russian women? I mean, it's a kind of sexist joke, really.
And is
it's
it? Also, oh, okay.
Yeah, but but it's also, you know, putting down Soviet women.
Right.
I mean, as much as you might dislike the government there, well, it's a joke that really...
Let me explain you.
The butt of the joke is the women, not the government.
Well, I look at it the other way. Maybe I'm wrong, but I'll explain you my point of view. The reason that Soviet women have the reputation that, you know, of not being as attractive as American women and stuff like that, basically comes back to the government. Basically, they work very hard. There is no living conditions as Americans have. There is no skincare products. There is no clothing that looks women attractive. There's no choices. So they're surviving. They're surviving. They have more pressure than the Russian man has. They work harder. They have to take care of the kids. They get older so much faster than American women, especially in the countryside. If you see in the big cities, you're dealing with more sophisticated women and stuff like that. When you're going a little bit further away from Moscow or Leningrad or Kyiv, Odessa, whatever, you will see some horror things. I mean, women work with their hands picking out potatoes out of the ground or beets or whatever, and you see their hands when they're 25-year-old girls or women. They're like, you wouldn't see that on an 80-year-old woman in America.
So you think the underwear joke is finally poking fun at the conditions that make it impossible to buy more underwear?
Yeah, basically. That's the way it was in Russia. That's the way people... And also, another reason is that American advertising sells on the pretty face. There's as many women probably in America who are overweight or whatever, you know, but they're not what you see when you turn on a television set or a magazine stand.
So who are some of the comics that you got to see when you were in the Catskills starting out?
Well, Jackie Mason. I saw Freddie Roman, if you know Freddie. It was older comedian. I mean, they're very funny, you know, but that
But they were the
style.
Older Borscht Belt comics.
Mm-hmm.
So did you start to think that that's what all American comics are like?
Yes, until I moved to Los Angeles.
And you got exposed to younger comics?
I got exposed to Robin Williams's and Richard Pryor's, and people would just, other comedians would just tell me, go watch, like, Richard Pryor movies and just memorize things. Just that's the way new comedy is. And I would go and I watched and I could not understand. I mean, I spoke English at that time better, but I still, I was saying, well, this man is unbelievable. But he also, I was thinking, he is a great human being. He talks about his parents all the time. Every other word, he kept mentioning his mother. And then I said, no, I think that's not his mother. That's somebody else's mother, you know. And it was very funny to me later on. But then that was the impression that I was getting.
Right, a little literal. Mm-hmm. So before you started watching Robin Williams and Richard Pryor and other comics, were you doing a routine that sounded like you were an aging Borscht Belt comic?
Pretty much, yeah. So, yeah. I mean, but from Russia, yeah.
My guest is comic Yakov Smirnoff, and we'll talk more about his life in America after we take a short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Comic Yakov Smirnoff is my guest, and he's written a new book called America on 6 Rubles a Day. When you started working the comedy clubs, you told us before in the Soviet Union there was no alcohol there, there weren't many hecklers. You must have had to really brace yourself for the temperamental American audiences.
Yes and no. I think that Soviet Union, is as weird as it's going to sound, what I'm going to say, is a great school for comedy. The reason is, you have so many restrictions in terms of you can't talk about politics, government, sex, religion. The rest is fine. But you train yourself to still be funny in those conditions. So it's like a athlete that runs with weights on his feet. You know, when he takes them off, all of a sudden he's better. And that's what I felt when I came to America. All of a sudden, I had so much more to talk about. And I felt that I also had trained myself to restrict myself to not to say dirty things. And I didn't really need to say it. But a lot of young comedians in America fall into that trap because they go in a nightclub where anything goes. You can be as gross as you want to be, as dirty as you want to be, and the shock effect to the audience makes them laugh. The audience laughs because they don't hear those words anywhere, on the streets, maybe in downtown somewhere, but that's it. So people laugh, and then it gives the person, the comedian, a false kind of security, and they need that for the rest of their lives. And I learned that right away when I came to America. I realized that on television you don't hear that, so you hopefully we'll learn how to do it without. And that's what my goal was.
Did any of the comedy club owners take advantage of you early on in your career, figuring that you were a foreigner and you really didn't know the ropes?
Well, yes, but it's not just me. It's everybody. Every comedian is willing to do things because laughter gives you such a high that they obviously have an opportunity to do so. But there are people who are wonderful. I mean, the owner of the Comedy Store in Los Angeles, to me, was like second mother, you know, and she kind of, you know, she took me when I didn't speak English well enough. And then eventually I had two mothers, so I was nagged in both languages, you know.
President Reagan had you perform at a White House dinner for the
Conservative Party Convention.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. How did he find out about you?
Well, I think I was invited by Conservative Party Convention, but I met the president a little bit earlier, like a month, I think, earlier before that. The gentleman who is the publisher of Washington Times, Arno de Borgegraf, have invited me to his house where he had the president for dinner in the president's honor. And I met with the president basically on like, it was 12 people there, and it was pretty intimate situation. And we were sitting at the same table, and and we were telling jokes to each other for like 2.5 hours. And it was like basically me and him telling jokes, and the rest of the people at the table were like listening. And it was fascinating. He's wonderful. He remembers so many stories. It's hard to believe. And especially he loves the Russian jokes. I mean, that's his specialty at this time. So I was very nervous at first, you know, because if he doesn't like it, it's like you'll never work this country again. But he was charming and made me feel very welcome.
You know, it's funny. You're finally in a country where you can make fun of the president in your routine if you want to, right? You can lampoon the president if you want to. You can do political humor if you want to. And so what's happened is you've become the president's friend.
Right,
so,
right. Well, I still do.
In some ways, maybe you're missing a great opportunity.
Nah, I still make jokes about the president. I do. I mean, I don't mind. If it's funny, it's funny. And I think he's one of those people who enjoys good laugh. And I don't see a problem with that at all. I talk about Iran-Contra. I talk about bombing of Iran oil well. I mean...
So you wouldn't feel uncomfortable
no.
about criticizing the president in your routine just because he likes your work?
It's America.
Do you think of yourself as a conservative comic?
Mm-hmm. I would say so, yeah. But I take chances, and I feel that coming from Russia to America gave me advantage of seeing America through the eyes of the foreigner. And also, now as an American, it gives me an opportunity to say, well, I'm one of you, and here are the things that I'm seeing that sound doesn't make sense to me. You know, Jim and Tammy Baker don't make sense, you know, or Gary Hart, you know, and stuff like that. So I try to cover as broad a base as possible.
My guest is comic Yakov Smirnov. With glasnost now in the Soviet Union and with a slight warming of relations between the Americans and the Soviets, is your anti-Soviet routine going over a little less well in the White House now? I mean, do they want to cool it a little with the anti-Soviet humor now?
I think it goes less in all over the country, basically, which is fine with me. I enjoy readjusting with what's going on in politics. I think that Americans are very much want what's happening with glasnost, and it's like a light in the end of the tunnel all of a sudden. And so I realized that, and I personally don't know which way it's going to go. Nobody does. But I still make jokes about what is going on. I mean, Gorbachev is obviously a great PR person. He obviously knows what sells in America, and he sells it very... I mean, he can package in America anything. It's like a car salesman. You know, you look at that guy with a birthmark on his head, shape of Poland, and you're saying to myself, well, would I buy a car from this guy? But then if he sells it right, you know, he has a book coming out. You heard it.
Yeah.
And the name of the book is probably would be like, How to Get Rid of Nuclear Missiles and Flabby Thighs in 30 Days, you know, just to sell. So I make jokes about that. I make jokes about modernizing everything in Soviet Union, that he said that he wants to replace hammer and a sickle with a power drill and a weed whacker. But you see, so I'm not doing any more jokes that I used to do more before, that was kind of comparing America to Soviet Union. Now I'm joking about things that are happening today. And I think people need that laugh. They are curious. Now, what's going to happen? Who is this guy? What input do you have to give us? And that's what makes them laugh and relaxed also when I'm approaching the issue. But I'm not going back as much as I was before and just trying to bash, as they were saying, you know, mother country or something like that.
How did you learn how to speak English? I think the most difficult thing to do when you're learning a new language is to figure out had a kid in that language, because
right.
humor has so much to do with the nuances of language, with puns and little ironies implicit in the way you phrase a sentence, and it's impossible to learn how to do that in a foreign language, and you've obviously mastered it.
Yeah, thank you. I think that it helped me in a way, because I'm like a kid looking at the new things, and if somebody's saying it's raining cats and dogs, you know, I'm saying, where did it come from? I mean, who would come up with it first time, you know? And when you say to a foreign person, you're like thinking, well, umbrellas wouldn't help. Windshield wipers probably go, oh, no, not the Dobermans, you know? So you're looking at all these little expressions or saying, you know, somebody says to me, come on over, we'll chew the fat. Where did that come from? I mean, it's like the picture in your mind is, I got it from the horse's mouth. I'm sure it's an old expression. It doesn't make any sense now, but people carrying it. And so to me, one thing was it was hard to learn about the language, but two, it was giving me a lot of stuff that Americans don't see every day. We get in the car and it says the door is ajar. And you're saying, I can't believe this. I mean, the door is ajar. And then you see people in the car laughing with you because they had that car for 2 years. They never heard it the way I heard it.
So the language seemed very surreal.
Oh, sure.
To you. But how'd you learn it? Did you go to classes?
Yeah,
or just pick
I took
it up?
Classes for about a month and a half. And that was it. They gave me a little basis of the language. But then after that, just talking to people kind of threw myself in the middle of it and start swimming.
I'm looking at your copy of the book. I had an earlier copy. I thought there was a subtitle. Here it is. Yeah. Mm-hmm. America on 6 rubles a day, or How to Become a Capitalist Pig.
Right. That's me.
Yeah. So do you feel like you're really going overboard with your spending now with a Rolls Royce and a big mansion in Los Angeles?
I feel pretty good doing that. I never had it. I never thought I would have it, but I don't think I am. I mean, it's possibly it looks like that, but I don't try to. I feel I'm getting to a certain level when I'm comfortable and I'm feeling secure with that. And I'm not trying to buy a helicopter or a boat or try to top Mr. Jones down the street. I'm enjoying it and it's fun. I mean, things are coming my way and I, you know, knock on wood. Is that an American expression?
Yes.
Yes. And why do we knock on wood? We don't know that, do we? And career is going good. Also, you know, things are going very well. And I'm going to be like in Las Vegas, for example.
That should be fun for you.
Yes. I mean, they offered me the Golden Nugget to headline, and that was like from out of the blue. And I said, wow, what a country. This is ultimate capitalism.
We only have a couple of seconds left, so I'll ask this quickly. I read that your parents live in the house that Lenny Bruce used to.
Right.
Do you feel a connection with Lenny Bruce, or was that coincidence?
Coincidence. I just found those needles, and I said, whose are those? No. No, it was just coincidence. It just happened to be in that area of Hollywood Hills where I guess it attracts comedians.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us about your life. Thanks a lot for being here.
Thank you.
Comic Yakov Smirnov has been my guest. He emigrated from the Soviet Union to America about 10 years ago and has since been on The Tonight Show and movies, clubs, and plus he has this new book, America on 6 Rubles a Day, which is published by Vintage Books. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On our next show, I'll speak with poet Kenneth Koch, so I hope you can join us. Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio. From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Coming up, playwright Wendy Wasserstein talks about her latest work, Drive, She Said. It's featured on the new PBS comedy series, Trying Times. Like her off-Broadway shows, Isn't It Romantic and Uncommon Women and Others, it's loosely based on her own experiences. Also, film critic Stephen Schiff reviews Hope and Glory, the new movie from John Boorman, who directed Deliverance and The Emerald Forest. And rock critic Ken Tucker reviews Introducing the Hard Line, according to Terence Trent D'Arby, the new album introducing this country to a rock and soul singer who's already a hit in England. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
This is Mara Liasson. Stock prices suffered a setback on Wall Street today. Analysts say record rallies the past 2 days have done little to restore confidence in the fragile market. According to unofficial figures, the Dow Jones Industrial Average fell more than 77 points in frantic trading today. Volume topped 394 million shares. The Dow plunged 140 points in the first hour of trading, then it took wild swings throughout the day, finally closing at 1950.43. Declines led advances 6-1. Several key banks lowered their prime interest rate a quarter point today, dropping the rate they charge their best customers to 9%. Analysts say the move increases the pressure on monetary officials to ease controls on the money supply. Experts say that by lowering their prime rate, the banks are in effect pleading with the Fed to abandon plans to keep interest rates high. The United States has condemned Iran for another silkworm missile attack. This time, an oil loading terminal off the Kuwaiti coast was hit. UPI's John Phillips has more.
A silkworm missile severely damaged Kuwait's main oil loading terminal at Sea Island in the first successful Iranian attack on the tiny state's offshore petroleum installations. Kuwaiti oil exports are expected to hold up despite the attack, but loading onto tankers will take three times as long. The Kuwaiti Foreign Ministry summoned the Iranian chargé d'affaires to receive a formal protest, but Tehran Radio reported the attack without claiming responsibility. The silkworm strike is sure to increase moderate Arab pressure on Washington to take out batteries of the missiles at the Fal Peninsula, but U.S. officials ruled out American retaliation since the attack was in Kuwaiti waters. John Phillips, Bahrain.
Secretary of State George Shultz and Soviet Foreign Minister Eduard Shevardnadze opened 2 days of talks in Moscow today, aimed at finalizing a medium-range nuclear missile agreement. The two leaders are also trying to set a date for a superpower summit. Soviet and U.S. officials say they've made progress in the talks so far and that the final details to be worked out are technical ones. The Nobel Peace Prize for Literature was awarded today to Joseph Brodsky, an exiled Russian poet. Brodsky, who is Jewish, now lives in New York City. He is one of the youngest Nobel laureates in the history of the award. He was asked how he found out that he had won.
I was in a Chinese restaurant with a friend of mine, and a friend of ours just came into the restaurant and told me that I should get home immediately.
Brodsky's first book of poetry was published in the United States in 1965 while the author was serving a sentence in a Siberian labor camp. A year after sanctions were imposed against South Africa, President Reagan has said they failed to bring about positive changes in the white minority government. Today, the Senate Subcommittee on African Affairs held a hearing to assess what the sanctions have accomplished. NPR's Phyllis Crockett reports.
Senator Ted Kennedy again called for stronger sanctions, and Chester Crocker restated the administration's position that sanctions don't work. Crocker, Assistant Secretary for African Affairs, is the architect of the administration's constructive engagement policy. Although the administration no longer uses that term, Crocker indicated today that creative diplomacy is still the approach the administration favors. Randall Robinson, Executive Director of TransAfrica, told Senator Jesse Helms, the ranking Republican on the subcommittee, that sanctions are not the problem.
The problem in the region is South Africa. The problem is not sanctions. Sanctions are a response to the problem. If you believe, Senator, that white South Africans are going to negotiate towards democracy absent Western pressure, you're either very naive or you don't want them to have this freedom.
I'm Phyllis Crockett in Washington.
And I'm Mara Liasson. For National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Our rock critic Ken Tucker has a review of a new album from Terence Trent D'Arby. D'Arby was born in New York. He did a stint with the army in Germany, then settled in England. But D'Arby's music still draws from his roots.
There's a new album called, intriguingly enough, Introducing the Hardline According to Terence Trent D'Arby. D'Arby is a big star in England, but of course that doesn't prove anything. So are Bucks Fizz, Shaken Stevens, and any number of British sensations that don't mean anything to us, and with good reason. But D'Arby is different. Listening to him sing, it's clear that he's been influenced by a certain strain of American soul singers. Gospel-trained balladeers like Al Green, Bill Withers, Otis Redding, and Marvin Gaye. He allows the natural graininess of his voice to surface and phrases in a deceptively artless, conversational style. You can hear all this in a song called Wishing Well.
Kissing like a bandit, stealing time underneath a sycamore tree. Cupid by the arson, Valentine's to my sweet lover and me. Slowly but surely, your appetite is more than I knew. Sweetly, softly, I'm falling in love with you. Wish me love, a wishing well, to kiss and tell. Me love a wishing well, to kiss and tell. Her wishing well, a crocodile she sang.
That's the new album, Introducing the Hardline, According to Terence Trent D'Arby. As that title implies, there's something a little arty and off-putting about D'Arby. In interviews, he's studiously vague about exactly what the hard line is, but you can gather from his music that it's a revitalization of 60s soul with an emphasis on the beat similar to 70s disco. I like the music for itself, but I also like it because it supports an idea I've had for the past year or so. To the ever-present pop question, what's going to be the next big thing, my answer has been, I think the next big thing will be a soul revival. Not the sort of retrograde nostalgia that characterized the big chill Motown rage a few years ago, but a further refinement of soul that takes into account the changes in style and technology over the past 20 years. After the mechanical smoothness of disco and the harsh bluntness of rap, I think the pop audience is ready for real singing again, for pretty melodies made more urgent by rough, aggressive instrumentation. Here's an example of what I mean, a song called Rain.
Back again, it's gonna rain.
Right now, Darby's record is slowly ascending the American record charts, but it remains to be seen whether he'll become successful in the U.S. In any event, Darby has made an album that can serve as a blueprint for anyone who wants to make soul music fresh and vivid in the 80s.
Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for the Philadelphia Inquirer. He reviewed Introducing the Hard Line, according to Terence Trent D'Arby. You're listening to Fresh Air. My guest is Wendy Wasserstein, who along with Beth Henley, Tina Howe, and Marsha Norman is one of the leading women playwrights making her mark in the theater today. Wasserstein writes comedies about her generation of educated women faced with choices about career, family, and relationships. She had a successful off-Broadway run with her play Isn't It Romantic, which told the story of two women trying to balance their lives between work, love, and the expectations of their parents. Wasserstein's new comedy, Drive, She Said, was written for the PBS television series Trying Times. It stars Terry Garr as an art history professor who is dumped by her snobbish boyfriend because she doesn't know how to drive a car.
I enjoyed our time together. But I've met someone else.
What?
I've met the woman who makes me whole. See, we never would have worked out. She loves cars. She adores them. She gets in and out of them for a living.
What, is she a car salesperson?
No, she's an actress.
She's an actress. What does she do? Play Hedda Gabler getting in and out of cars?
She's the girl on the Dukes of Hazzard. I like you, Robin, but you're stuck in this academic world of Fabergé eggs and takeout Chinese. You refuse to move forward. You won't even learn to drive.
Wendy Wasserstein, do you know how to drive?
I do, but I just learned a year ago. It took me 2 years to learn. But I'm very proud of that.
Why did you write your Trying Times episode about learning to drive?
Well, because the producer, John Denny, came to me and said, we want an episode about some difficulty in modern times. And I guess I was approached with the project right after I had learned to drive. And it was such a huge thing to me. I mean, for me, getting a license, I think, is like for other people graduating medical school. It was really a trauma. So
why was it such a big deal?
Well, I grew up in Manhattan and I never had to drive. And even when I went away to college, I would hitchhike or take buses. It was just something I never thought I would do. And I started learning when I was 35. So it seemed sort of this deliberate choice. It became metaphorical to me.
Did you go to a driving school or learn from a friend, family?
No, I'm a graduate of the Taggart School of Driving. And I studied with Alma Rivera, was my driving instructress.
Did you ever say to yourself, I can write hit plays, but I can't parallel park?
No, I just became very impressed with everyone who could parallel park. Because I thought, in a way, in life, it's nice to write plays, but you're really called upon to parallel park more often.
The premise of the Trying Times series is the kind of small traumas that people experience. Was it liberating in any way to have to choose a theme that doesn't have big issues, that isn't very profound?
Absolutely. It really was. I mean, sometimes you write things that is just a nice small piece, and especially because I write plays, and that tends to be on larger issues, and sometimes you just want to do something nice. I mean, actually, you see that a lot in painting. You see, you know, someone who's done a sketch or, you know, just a little work between works that's well crafted. And I think it's important that that be done more in writing, too, because it keeps your craft alive. It keeps, you know, keeps it moving and refined.
You were in college at the height of the counterculture and at the beginning of the modern wave of feminism. When you started writing, did you ever have trouble finding themes that reflected your generation's values and that also reflected your perspective as a woman?
That's what I've tried to write about. I've tried to sort of, in an almost sociological way, try to touch on that. I just wrote a play. In fact, my new play is about the women's movement in some way or changes over the past 25 years. But it's just that I try to do it comedically because I think it's a way of taking people in a sense, or having them listen.
So what are some of the issues you get to in your new play?
Well, just about how a political movement can affect someone's life personally. And those changes about, and how seriously one takes these things, that they are in fact very serious.
So instead of the personal as political, this is the political as personal.
Yes, that's right. That's right.
Your first play, Uncommon Women, was about a group of women having their first reunion since graduating from a prestigious women's college, Mount Holyoke. Was that based on your experiences in college?
Yeah, I'm a graduate of Mount Holyoke. I tend to use whatever's happened to me. It's like driving. So, yes, it was. I mean, it's not specifically me and my friends, but it was certainly, you know, my experiences at Holyoke and being in a girls' school and being in the middle of the wilderness with all these girls dressed in hostess gowns. So it's pretty strange.
Why did you go to a women's college?
Oh, gosh. Well, I went to a women's high school, too. Those other schools like Yale and Dartmouth were not co-ed at the time. And a part of me thought, oh, if I go to this prestigious college, then my parents will be happy with me forever. So, but I think that was a false assumption. I also, when I went up there, it seemed special. And I've always been attracted to places and things that seem sort of special or a little unique.
Are you glad that you did?
Yes, I am, actually. In retrospect, I'm actually a believer in female education, oddly enough, because I was so unhappy there. But I do believe in it. I like my friends from there a lot, which is what, in a way, Uncommon Women is about. And I think, just like what we were saying before, the political is personal. In a place like that, you're not told, oh, you're a woman and therefore you're great. There are assumptions, very basic underlying assumptions that I think are very important. I mean, I think partially I'm a writer because of that experience, because there was a basic confidence in one's own voice.
The women in your play, Uncommon Women, have to take sessions in gracious living
yes.
where they learn how to sip tea and be a proper guest or a proper hostess.
Right.
Did you have to take those?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. I mean, that's what was so strange, because I seem more like someone who went to Hunter High School in New York or something. This was every Wednesday and Sunday we had to wear dresses and have tea with the house mother in the living room. It was so bizarre. And I know how to get in and out of a taxi and like cross my legs in the right way. I never do it, but I know how.
So. I think a theme that runs through several of your plays is women trying to figure out what kind of lives they want to live,
uh-huh.
what kind of adults they want to be. Was that difficult for you to figure out when you got out of college? Did you flounder around for a while trying to figure out what you wanted to do with your life?
It still is. I don't think it's over. I wish I could tell you yes and I figured it out and I'm marvelously happy. I mean, I think that it's something that goes on for a long time. My elder sister is 50 and is quite an interesting woman, and she's still, you know, grappling with these things. My mother still is. I think that there are a lot of choices and there are a lot of definitions. And especially with women, we're given a different definition every 4 years. So 4 years ago, we were told to have it all. And now we're told to be, I think we're beginning to be told to become wonderful mothers again. I get that sense. So I think, yes, I'm someone who's still grappling with that.
Did you know early on that you wanted to be a playwright or to write?
I love the theater. I mean, I love going into a room and the lights come down and people, and it's just very exciting to me. And so the thought that you could do that with your life and someone paid you for it seemed extraordinary to me. No, I didn't always know that. When I was in college, I applied to law school and business school, and I went to the Yale School of Drama only because I got in, and I thought, well, I have a shot at doing what seems interesting, and let's see what happens.
But you were prepared to not get in, and you were prepared to not actually make it in theater and be a lawyer instead.
Oh, I sent a deposit to the Columbia Business School. My picture was in the handbook. And when Isn't It Romantic was running, the very nice dean wrote me a note and said, oh, I loved your play, and I think you made the right choice, but if ever you change your mind, and I've held on to that letter. So
you're not still planning on changing your mind, are you?
No, I don't think so, but I thought, well, no, not especially today. Business doesn't look so good. I might be better off telling jokes on CBS. I don't know.
Can I ask you a practical question about playwriting?
Go ahead.
You can only write so many plays, and
that's
people
right.
tend to not churn them out, and there's mm-hmm. only a certain number of stages that can put on plays.
Uh-huh.
What do you do in between plays to make a living?
Well, darling, it's not a get-rich-quick scheme, I can tell you that. And neither is public television. So, you have to do something else. So a lot of people write film. I've write screenplays, television. I also write for a magazine called New York Woman, and I have a column in there, which is terrific for me. So I think some people teach, you get grants. There are different ways, really. It depends.
One last thing.
Uh-huh.
You told us at the beginning of the interview that you wrote Drive, She Said, mm-hmm. because you had recently learned how to drive, and there were so many troubles associated with that. It was such a trauma for you.
Oh, awful.
Well, now that you have your driver's license, you're still living in New York. Do you have much occasion to drive?
I have to rent a car on Saturday to drive to Vermont, and I'm already having an anxiety attack about it. I don't think I've really gotten a hold of it yet. So...
what's the problem? Is it driving or actually renting the car?
No, I can rent the car. It's merging lanes. That I can't get on the highway and merge the lane. I just can't do it. So,
well, have a good trip.
Oh, thanks a lot.
Thanks a lot okay. for talking with us.
Thank you.
Wendy Wasserstein wrote Drive, She Said, the second program in the new PBS comedy series Trying Times. This is Fresh Air. You can hear full coverage of today's news on All Things Considered. Robert Siegel, who co-hosts the program, is joining us from Washington. Hi, Robert.
Hello, Terry.
More on the market today?
More on the market. We'll have a report from Barbara Mantell in New York on how the stock exchange did. Also, we'll be talking with Professor Jeremy Siegel of the Wharton School of Finance at the University of Pennsylvania. We spoke to him earlier in the week. Now, Professor Siegel, no relation, by the way, will tell us about technical analysts and why it is that folks who study the charts of prices have so much influence on the market today, and why one can predict, and all will follow his predictions. Also, a talk with Craig Claiborne, the noted cooking writer, about his new book called Southern Cooking.
Thanks, Robert. Those stories and more are coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. There's a new movie from the British director John Borman. It's called Hope and Glory, and it's a reminiscence about his youth. Our film critic Stephen Schiff has a review.
From his movie Point Blank in 1967 to The Emerald Forest 2 years ago, John Borman's films have all felt like dreams. They've always been visually splendid, incredibly detailed, a little bit scary, and a little bit incoherent. Disturbing dreams. Dreams from which you awaken feeling awkward and touchy and out of sorts. Now, with Hope and Glory, he's created one of those jolly dreams that makes you laugh out loud in your sleep. The movie is his memoir of a boyhood in London during the Blitz, and its central joke is that the air raids and the stern patriotic speeches on the radio, and even the death and destruction going on all around him, were like a wonderful childhood game, the only childhood game that the grown-ups took as seriously as the kids did. Marvelous hideouts could be had in the ruins of neighbors' houses, and every kid collected great toys, bits of shrapnel, live bullets, unexploded bombs. My favorite scenes involve a little kid's street gang made up of 9 and 10-year-olds, a gang that gets to do what other gangs only fantasize about, threatening outsiders with real weapons, for instance, and coaxing favors out of their elders with real jewels scavenged from the wreckage. The movie takes a cockeyed delight in the war, but it nearly makes you believe that that's as reasonable as the view taken by the film's more responsible citizens. For instance, this school teacher, who tries to use a map to color-code the conflict for her wards.
Pink. 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 What are all the pink bits? Rowan.
The Osmonds.
Yes. The British Empire. What fraction of the Earth's surface is British? Jennifer Baker.
2/5, miss.
Yes, 2/5. Ours. That's what this war is all about. Men are fighting and dying to save all the pink bits for you, ungrateful little twerps.
Hope and Glory concentrates on one family, our prepubescent hero, his anxious mother and timid, hard-drinking father, and his two sisters, one about 5 or 6, and the other a sexy teenager in love with a Canadian soldier. The acting is mostly delicious, except for Sarah Miles as the mother. She flaps about theatrically and never quite brings her character into focus. There are other problems, too. The movie's very light and very anecdotal, and after a while it begins to suffer for the lack of something richer and deeper and more gripping underneath. Once the charm and novelty of a child's eye view of war have passed, you want the child to grow up a bit. What had seemed tart and refreshing in his attitudes begins to feel precious, and the movie takes on a sentimental glaze. Worse, the final third whisks us out of the rubbly suburban neighborhood to the mother's parents' house in a sylvan glade along the Thames. There we spend endless hours watching our hero cope with his comically irascible grandfather, who's unbearably overplayed by Ian Bannon, and wondering why Boorman thinks this listless, tacked-on episode has anything to do with what has gone before it. Boorman has said that the period he spent on the river with his grandfather was one of the central incidents of his childhood. And indeed, river imagery is one of the constants of his filmmaking, but none of this makes the final 40 minutes of his movie any more fun to sit through. Watching Hope and Glory is sometimes a little bit like listening to someone go on too long telling you what he dreamt last night. But at its best, for most of its first two-thirds, Boorman makes it a dream that feels as vivid and entrancing as our own.
Stephen Schiff is critic at large for Vanity Fair. Here's a look at the next Fresh Air. Next time, I'll speak with novelist and screenwriter William Goldman. His screenplays for Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, All the President's Men, and Marathon Man established his Hollywood credentials, but it still took years to get his 1973 novel, The Princess Bride, made into a movie. Also, Ellen Pfeiffer, music critic for the Boston Herald, will review the brief career of cellist Jacqueline Dupre, who died Monday after a 16-year struggle with multiple sclerosis. And Ken Tucker will review new home video releases, including one featuring comic Tim Conway in a parody of instructional golf videos. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person. Ed Doherty and Lisa Bruton are the production assistants. Our engineer is Richard Parker. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. Our theme music is composed and performed by Jackie Byard. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.